whether some efficiency can be obtained there. And Olin is also considering this. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, what we're going to do then is not take our break. And we will then come back and do agenda item 25, and then we'll go right into 26, which is the Salinas permit issue. And we will then be postponing agenda items 14, 15, and 16 until most likely after lunch. Okay? And we'll meet back, let's say, at 5 of 11. And Mr. Briggs, when you're ready, you can introduce this agenda item and get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we have on the agenda, today, two of the permitting issues, one being the city of Salinas for their so-called Phase 1 stormwater permit, and then we did have on the agenda the Monterey Regional Phase 2, we thought that it would be very beneficial for the board and for everyone else, actually, to have an overview of our stormwater program to kind of put into context the Phase 1 and the Phase 2 aspects of the stormwater program. So we provided a written report, and Jennifer Bidding of our staff, I guess in concert with Kimberly Gonzalez, will be providing a presentation of that, which is item 25.
Thank you, Mr. Briggs. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Bidding, and I'm the Stormwater Program Manager, so it's fitting for me to give you an update on our stormwater program. I'd like to talk about our two phases of the program, Phase 1 and Phase 2, and the four aspects of our program, which include construction, industrial, municipal, and Caltrans. The construction, industrial, and Caltrans permits are general permits. They're statewide permits adopted at the state board, and those are covered in my staff report. However, I will not be discussing those today. I'd like to focus on the municipal program. But I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have about those construction, industrial, or Caltrans programs or permits. The municipal stormwater program update will include a discussion of the Phase 1 and Phase 2 regulations and which municipalities are affected, the maximum extent practicable standard, which applies to municipal permits, our stormwater management plan philosophy of regional board staff, and also our review process. The Phase 1 regulations are published in the Federal Register. They were published in 1990. They require discharges from municipal separate storm sewer systems, which I commonly refer to as MS4s, with a population of 100,000 or more to be permitted. And the Regional Board adopted an individual permit for the City of Salinas in 1999. The Phase 2 regulations, which are published in the Federal Register, the 99 Register, require that smaller municipalities obtain permit coverage. So a general permit was adopted at the state board level for our small MS4s. That was adopted in April 30th of 2003. And a complete application for that permit includes a stormwater management plan, electronic and hard copy, a notice of intent to comply with the terms of the permit, and a fee based on population as described in the fee schedule, as well as a map showing permit boundaries. There are three main categories that are required to obtain permit coverage under this general MS4 permit. The first category is the designated MS4s located within urbanized areas. These are included in Attachment 1 of the permit. Urbanized areas is actually a term defined by the U.S. Census Bureau, but roughly it's municipalities with a population of 50,000 or more and a density of 1,000 per square mile. We have about 27 of these within our region. The second main category required to obtain permit coverage are the designated MS4s located within urban clusters. Urban clusters is also a definition that comes from the U.S. Census Bureau. It's approximately population of 10,000 or greater with a density of 1,000 or more per square mile. We have 10 of these municipalities in our region, and they are listed in Attachment 2 of the permit. also required to obtain permit coverage. The third category are the non-traditional MS4s. Those are governmental entities such as universities, prisons, military bases, and school districts that are either located within or adjacent to a regulated MS4. They're also required to apply for permit coverage, and we have 91 of these in our region. The permit standard for compliance is the MEP standard. It's referred to as MEP. It stands for Maximum Extent Practicable. And this definition I took from the Salinas permit as well as the Phase 2 general permit. So it's a technology-based standard established by Congress in the Clean Water Act that all municipal stormwater permit holders must meet. The MEP approach is a flexible advancing concept which focuses on technical feasibility. However, cost effectiveness and public acceptance are also relevant. So as knowledge about controlling urban runoff continues to evolve, so does that which constitutes MEP. Some things have changed since the first permit, our first Salinas permit, was adopted in 1999. And one of the changes that has been made to our interpretation of MEP is that Order 2000-11 was adopted by the State Board in the year 2000. This revised the development standards for MEP the development standards for Phase 1 MS4s that constitute MEP. It includes a list of best management practices for those development categories and numeric design standards for structural treatment control BMPs. This order, 2000-11, however, did not consider Phase 2 stormwater permits. Getting back to the Phase 2 requirements, the stormwater management plan minimum control measures there are six of them. They're pretty self-explanatory, so I won't read the list to you. The only one that might not be self-explanatory might be post-construction. Post-construction refers to things that happen after a construction project is complete, controlling the runoff, so things like development standards and low-impact development and things like that. Region 3's staff has a stormwater management plan philosophy that I wanted to share with you. Essentially, the idea is to require that the stormwater management plan first correctly identify pollutants of concern, and then once those pollutants of concern have been identified, accurately identify the pollutant sources. Then next, select best management practices to adequately address each pollutant source. And then lastly, appropriately measure the effectiveness of each BMP. So essentially, as you move through this sort of step-by-step approach of adequately identifying your pollutants of concern and their sources, and then choosing best management practices to address them, and then measuring the effectiveness, then that will take you back essentially to the beginning. If you find that any of your best management practices are not effective, you would go back to the beginning and reevaluate once again your pollutant sources and pollutants of concern to see if you have missed any. This might answer Dr. Press's question earlier about trash and whether or not to implement drop inlet screening devices or something like that. Essentially, the idea is to address the pollutants at the source, so to prevent trash from even getting down to the drop inlets in the first place. However, if that isn't possible, then they might want to, as they go through the process, a municipality might find more trash arriving there and might want to consider some other measure. So that sort of cyclical process of the iterative process sort of brings them, hopefully, to the point where eventually all pollutant sources are addressed. So our philosophy is that it's not necessarily which BMP you select or how many BMPs, but it's why you choose that suite of BMPs that matters most. So, for example, some vendors of best management practices might say that theirs is the best. However, from regional board staff perspective, we're not holding one best management practice up higher than another. We're mainly looking for the reasons behind selecting the BMPs that matter to make sure that each best management practice is carefully selected to address those pollutants. The Phase 2 stormwater management plan review process is a lengthy one, and so I wanted to sort of describe that process to you. First, the stormwater management plans are received by regional board staff, and next, they are reviewed. If in our review we determine that the stormwater management plan does not comply with the terms of the permit, then a review letter is sent to the municipality describing our concerns and requesting that another stormwater management plan or an amended stormwater management plan be submitted to our office addressing our concerns. Once the stormwater management plan is received, it's reviewed again. So we could be in this cycle until we eventually receive a stormwater management plan that complies with the permit. Once we do, it is posted on the web for a 60-day public comment period, and the public has an opportunity to comment on the stormwater management plan. If there are no comments, then the stormwater management plan is approved and permit coverage begins on that 61st day. If we do receive comments, however, then the regional board staff works with the MS4 as well as the commenters, either through telephone meetings or through meeting in person, to try to remedy any of the discrepancies or any of the concerns, to see if we can come to a consensus and hopefully possibly make changes to the stormwater management plan that are acceptable to both the MS4 as well as the commenter. If those changes are not significant, then the stormwater management plan is approved and permit coverage begins. However, if the changes are significant, the stormwater management plan is reposted to the web for another public comment period. If the changes are not acceptable, then the regional board will have a hearing, such as the one that we will have on the Monterey stormwater management plan that's been continued to the next meeting. This is a update of where we are in the stormwater management plan review process, and this is an attachment to my staff report, so if you're unable to see the small text, it is attachment A of my staff report. It's broken down into attachment 1 MS4s and attachment 2 MS4s there on the bottom, and it sort of gives you an idea for where we are in the review process. You can see that a hearing has been requested for 10 of the MS4s in our region. 9 of those are in the Monterey area. That was on the agenda for today, but has been continued to the March meeting. You can tell that 2 have gained permit coverage. Paso Robles and Soledad have gained permit coverage. And I might mention that the asterisk that you see next to the name of the municipality just denotes that that municipality is subject to the attachment 4 design standards.
Why aren't the others subject to that?
The permit requires that municipalities with a population of 50,000 or more, or a growth rate of 25% over 10 years or more, must incorporate the attachment 4 conditions into their stormwater management plan. So those are the ones that fit either one of those categories. You'll see up on the screen that there are counties listed, and I just wanted to clarify that when I list a county, I'm speaking of, in sort of general terms, only the urbanized areas require permit coverage within that county. So, for example, the County of Monterey is only required to cover in their stormwater management plan Carmel Valley Village, Castroville, Pajaro, and Prunedale, because those are the urbanized areas within the county. However, the County of Santa Cruz, for example, has opted to include the entire county. But only the urbanized areas are required at a minimum to be covered under the stormwater management plan. So I just wanted to let you know that that's what I'm referring to when the counties are listed there.
Why is Tular not on that list in Monterey County?
The list is only of urbanized areas or urban clusters, which is defined by the U.S. Census Bureau. And so that would mean that that entity would have to have a population of 10,000 or more and a density of 1,000 or more per square mile. So I don't believe they fit that category.
No, doesn't meet that category.
So I would like to update you at a subsequent board meeting about our non-traditional MS4s. There are so many of them, I did not want to take up too much time in this update. There are 91 of them, so I'd like to bring an update on the status of those stormwater management plans, where we are in the process of reviewing those at a subsequent meeting. I'd also like to include Attachment A in the Executive Officer's Report until all of our Phase 2 stormwater management plans have been adopted, so that you can see them all move through the process and know where they are.
UC Santa Cruz fits into that non-traditional?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yes. Going backwards, Jennifer, to where the second swamp has been submitted and the second review letter sent, that those two columns there.
Okay.
Do you have an idea when those second review letters are going to be sent out on those entities? And the reason for the question is I ran into Rob Almy on the street, and he had mentioned that the county of Santa Barbara at least had been waiting for a review letter, and I'm just wondering if we have a kind of a backlog of work to do with reviewing what has been submitted.
Essentially, you can tell there's a lot that
right.
we have at the moment. We have not only all 27 of the Attachment 1s and all 10 of the Attachment 2s, we have all 91 of our Attachment 3 stormwater management plans that we're in the process of reviewing. So the way that they are prioritized is based on when they came in, when we received them, and then also as we review one and send out a letter and wait for them to submit the next version of their stormwater management plan, then we start to review the next one and send out a letter. So they're all kind of happening just as time permits. So as one letter has been sent, then we review another one, send another letter, get the next one back. So it's kind of a difficult process to predict. So as to when the letter will be sent, I can't say for sure, but within the next few months, I imagine.
Okay. You know, are they listed in terms of when the swamps were submitted? For that column, second swamp has been submitted to Santa Barbara County first on that list?
No.
No.
I'm
okay.
Sorry, they're not in that order.
Bruce.
I notice you start your staff report by mentioning the purpose of the program is to prevent the discharge of pollutants to surface water bodies by preventing stormwater runoff from acting as a vehicle for pollution. Why are we are not discussing the fact that simple quantities of stormwater itself is a problem? You know, produces erosion and things like that. And why don't we deal with that and make that upfront as a goal that they need to achieve?
Yes, I would say that was an oversight on the part of my writing my staff report, because we definitely do within our process of our programs. Now it's going to take me quite a while to get back through my presentation. So definitely our program is focusing on pollutants as well as the increased volume and velocity of stormwater as being a pollutant in and of itself, because of the fact that it creates erosion and can blow out creeks and streams. And that is definitely covered under the post-construction aspect of the program. That's the whole idea behind the post-construction program. Our aspect of the program is that development standards are adopted that allow for stormwater to be infiltrated on site or captured or treated on site or in regional areas, rather than sending all of the runoff, increased runoff from increased development to creeks and streams. So that is definitely a part of the program.
It seems like the best way to deal with a lot of those problems isn't post-construction, it'd be pre-construction, right? Construction design principles, building requirements, things like that.
Absolutely, and that is part of the program. Post-construction is, I use that because that's the federal term, that's the term in the federal regulations. It is a bit of a misnomer. That's why I like to call it development standards instead of post-construction. It's development standards that apply to post-construction and what will happen after construction, but it definitely takes place long before construction. It's part of the design process and plan check process, so it requires the municipalities to implement a program so that they can foresee before development actually takes place where that stormwater will go and control and direct it before.
And in dealing with those kinds of runoff issues, do we do it strictly through BMPs or MEPs, or can we also set goals like stormwater runoff should be no more than pre-development levels or something like that?
Yeah, the permits do set that sort of goal, especially for the municipalities that are required to meet Attachment 4. Mm-hmm. And the Attachment 4 provisions are more stringent than the rest of the permit. So they are required to actually meet those sorts of goals.
In terms of what we can require, the federal standard is that the stormwater pollutants have to be reduced to the maximum extent practicable, and that we can impose any more stringent requirements that are appropriate. So in the attachment 4 and the phase 1 permits, there are some more stringent requirements on receiving water that are met through this iterative process, and that's a more stringent than MEP requirement. And the goals for the BMPs are, it's really part of the analysis of what's MEP and what BMPs are appropriate.
One of the things we talked about this morning, you probably heard, with the plastics, is the idea of trying to get education actually down to the schools. And how is there a way we can accomplish that? I mean, a lot of these organizations we're talking to don't control the schools, so how does this get happen?
That is why non-traditional MS4s are required to obtain permit coverage, and that includes school districts. So that means that those school districts have to have a stormwater management plan, and they have to have a public education component, which means educating their school children. So, and the State Board actually has worked on a program called Erase the Waste, which is a campaign that has taken place in the LA Basin, but is being developed in a way that it can be used throughout the state. And it is a specific, it's a campaign that takes place currently now in LA through lots of different media, through billboards and lots of other things. But one part of that program is an actual curriculum to be used within schools that has actually been approved by the school districts to actually be, to meet the standards that curriculum must meet in order to be taught in California public schools. So there's also an other program called WET, which stands for Water Education for Teachers. And so that educates teachers so that they can then teach their students about stormwater and water quality issues and things like that. So there are a lot of programs out there that the school districts can adopt or use that have already been developed so that their teachers can teach their school children about.
Do you know if plastics are included in any of these programs?
I'm not totally familiar with all of the lessons within the curriculum. I just know that the curriculum is based on stormwater and that it has been approved to be used in California public schools. I think that it's probably addressing some of the more basic concerns, at least for the start. That's my assumption. But I'm not sure if it specifically addresses plastics. Although since it did, it was originally focused for the LA Basin where there is a zero trash TMDL, there, it might.
Okay. That'd be good to know, I think.
Yeah. I think if my daughter's curriculum is any example, the ocean science components are pretty good at covering plastics, especially in our region because we have so many coastal communities, and it's easy to get marine biologists to come in to do that kind of education. One of the things I worry about in this kind of program is how much we're going to be able to distinguish between policy outcomes versus policy outputs. The policy outputs consist of the planning documents, the swamps that are being produced. But if I were to be on this board as long as my esteemed colleague, Mr. Jeffries, would I in 10 years be sitting here and getting data from board staff that said to me, look, here's where we were with stormwater. Here are some baseline assessments, and then here are measurements along those assessments. Now, I understand that phase two is just really kind of gearing up in a big way. So I understand that the region's efforts have been concentrated in basically permit compliance. But the bigger picture for me, the bigger question is, what sense do we have that we have baseline data? Because when you say something like maximum extent practicable, when you say reductions in this or that, you need to know relative to what? Reductions from what? So how confident can we be and can the municipalities be that progress is being made? How consistent are the data? How comparable are the data? How consistently collected are the data? That doesn't jump out at me, so maybe you could speak to that.
Okay. Well, I am definitely talking in generalities here because I'm talking about the permit, which is general, and then, of course, the stormwater management plans that the municipalities submit to us to review, that is their site-specific detailed information about how they're going to carry out the permit requirements. So in those plans is where they would describe to us, before we are willing to approve it, describe to us how they intend to measure the effectiveness of their BMPs. And so since they have not begun to do it yet, since they are just submitting their plans and permit coverage won't start until we've approved the plan, so they won't start implementing these things, or I should say they're not required to start implementing these things until we approve it. We don't have data right now because the program hasn't yet begun. However, the backbone of the permit is this process of moving through addressing each pollutant source, figuring out what your pollutant sources are, choosing best management practices that you think will adequately address those, and then measuring the effectiveness. And they have to tell us specifically how they're going to do that. And then if it turns out through that measurement of effectiveness that those BMPs are not effective, then they need to go back and choose additional BMPs.
And what are their measurements? Are they going to do first flush kinds of measurements? Are they going to have some kind of sampling protocol that gives them enough statistical power that they can generalize from a few storm drains or a few outfalls to the whole system? I mean, how sophisticated and accurate is your sense that these are going to be, and how are you going to tell?
It's varied because we have so many different kinds of municipalities. We have some that are large. We have some that are very small. We have some that are right on the coast and some that are further inland. So the sophistication of that process for each municipality varies based on all of those different factors. However, some are including actual water quality sampling or monitoring, such as First Flush or Urban Watch, things like that, where they're actually taking data from certain points, and they have been for a while. Some of the municipalities within our region have been doing this for quite some time. So other minimum control measures, though, don't necessarily lend themselves to that as much, and so there's other kinds of monitoring for those. So when you talk to people who work within the municipality and they're seeing their storm drains and their storm sewer system, they're seeing changes to it. They know what the pollutant sources are and where the quote-unquote hotspots are. Just that kind of visual monitoring actually gives us a lot of information as well. So sometimes visual monitoring is required. Other kinds of monitoring might be actually surveying the population to see how much they know. So after a public education campaign has been in place for a year or two, surveying the population to see what they've learned from that and to see if there's been behavioral changes.
Yeah, I would caution us not to put, I know this won't be a very popular thing to say, but I would caution us not to put too much reliance on K-12 education. It's a great thing to do, but K-12 kids are not contractors going out and doing, and they may or may not remember and be able to act on what they've learned as a kid when they become, 20 years later. So that's one piece of it. But
yeah, and public education actually refers to not just school children, but all of the different aspects of the public. So each different business category and reaching out to those, as well as just the public in general and their general knowledge of the fact that the storm sewer system actually goes to a creek or stream. So all of those things.
Jennifer, I'm sort of getting maybe a little more specific on the public education part of it. This one to me, this bothers me. It seems a little vague. Do we have any control? I know we can't tell them what to do, but that they have to do it. And my concern is, do we review the materials that they're putting out there, and do we have some say in? Okay, good.
Yes, yeah.
My other concern is how do they measure that? I mean, I saw one document where their measurement was that they printed them up and put them out. That's not a measurement of the effectiveness. That's just a measurement of whether they, did what they said they were going to do. So I'm concerned about how they're going to be measuring the public education component. It's one thing to print up brochures and stick them in the libraries and at City Hall, and it's another thing to actually, you know, educate people to change their actions on these issues. So I'm just a little concerned on that, because that's an easy one where these entities can print up a bunch of brochures and say, we took care of that.
Yeah, actually, I understand your concern completely, because that's Regional Board staff's concern as well, is that we have public education programs that are easy to determine whether or not they're actually making a difference. And so that was an issue that we pay careful attention to as we review stormwater management plans. And I know it's probably difficult to sit here and listen to my sort of general update and not know the specifics of the details that we're seeing within the stormwater management plans. But that's why we require that they explain within their stormwater management plan if they're doing something, such as brochures. We want to know what is the message and who is the target audience, and will they be receiving them? So, for example, if you're putting it just in the library, is all of your population really going to have an opportunity to be exposed to that? So that's definitely an issue of concern for us. And so we ensure that no stormwater management plan is adopted until we feel that all of the different aspects of the public, whether they're just the general public or individual industries or school children, all the different aspects are educated in a way that will actually reach them. So whether you're talking radio or television or whatever the message is, so that it actually gets out to the right people. And then also not only measuring whether or not it occurred, so for example measuring, like, did you print up all the brochures and actually hand them out, that just measures whether or not it occurred, but then also measuring whether or not there is an impact on water quality or an actual change, a behavior change. So
do we do things like requiring surveys? I know the water district that I'm president of, we've recently done a water survey just to ask folks, do you even know where your water's coming from? Do you know about the problems? And we're going to do that before we do any kind of programs and after. I mean, why not do a monitoring program for education just like we do for BMPs?
Exactly. And many municipalities are doing that first, starting out with a survey to figure out what does their public know about stormwater so far? What is sort of the baseline understanding? How much do they understand?
And but we don't require that?
Well, it's the permit itself does not require it. Staff, as we are reviewing stormwater management plans, we definitely make sure that they have some way, the municipalities have some way of knowing what the need is. So whether it's through a survey or through some other way, they have to convince us that they know what the need is for public education. And
but also follow up, as Gary's suggesting, with the measurement afterwards to see
right.
if you've actually accomplished anything at all, or you've just printed things and put them on the back step of the county jail and no one actually took them in.
Yeah, that is definitely part of our review process and the things that we're looking for as we review stormwater management plans.
With these phase two permits, what's the lag time between the first year and sampling and when BMPs need to be installed? I mean, do they get a chance to do a round of sampling, get some idea of what their pollutant issues are before choosing BMPs, or do they have to do that in the first year?
Well, the time schedule for full implementation, of course, they have the full 5 years to reach full implementation. The time schedule for implementing best management practices for each one of the six minimum control measures varies with each stormwater management plan. There's no set time schedule. So they have to tell us how soon can they get it done. I mean, how soon can you get an ordinance adopted, or how soon can you implement these BMPs? How soon can you get your public education program up and running? Mm-hmm. And so the time schedule is different for all of them. So, and some municipalities are, you know, waiting to collect actual water quality data until they've implemented their best management practices so they can see if they're working or not.
So why would they want to implement any BMPs without having some idea actually a problem?
I guess the assumption that they already have some knowledge, either through volunteer sampling programs or things like that.
Tell me a little bit about what enforcement options staff has available to it in terms of getting compliance with these phase two and I guess the phase one permit too.
Sure.
Are these like NPDES permits?
Absolutely, they are definitely
NPDES permits.
Just like
the Clean Water Act, enforced by public citizen suits?
Well,
if need be.
It could be enforced by ACLs for a maximum of $10,000 per day, a violation of the permit. It is subject to third-party lawsuits because it's an NPDES permit.
Okay.
The stormwater management plans for the phase two permit are, we ensure that we don't approve it until we feel that it is enforceable. So that there are definite deadlines that they will do something by that makes it enforceable to us. If they say we will have an ordinance by a certain day or we will have I think that's Donette's dog probably. She's homesick. I guess maybe we should mention that Donette Dunaway, our stormwater staff person for the Monterey County area, is on the phone. That's why you heard that noise. You just heard her dog.
I think she's got a cold.
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't her. She does have the flu, and she sounds horrible, but she doesn't sound that bad.
That was just her editorial comment on that question.
Well, you know, my question is, I've noticed there's an iterative process involved here.
Yes, that's correct.
Which puts kind of shifts the burden onto the discharger to be monitoring, self-assessing, and on its own, you know, taking appropriate measures to implement BMPs and to do reduction. So does that create enforcement windows?
Absolutely. Okay. I think all of the stormwater program permits are that way. Same is true for the construction permit, the industrial permit, the Caltrans permit, and as well as these municipal permits that the regulations essentially assume that the permit holder will be honest about putting in best first notifying us that they need permit coverage, installing best management practices, reporting to us annually. That burden of complying with the permit is on them. The room or opportunity for enforcement is when we catch them not doing those things. So that's why we do inspections of construction sites and industrial facilities, and we audit our municipal permit holders. So far we've only had one, City of Salinas, but we audit the permit holder by going and interviewing the staff and determining what's going on, as well as doing assessment in the field, actually walking around throughout the city to see if all the storm drains really are stenciled and things like that. So so there is definitely room for enforcement because there's definite timelines for compliance and things that must be done. And so if those aren't, then there is room for enforcement.
How many staff do we have to work on stormwater permits?
There's five of us.
Five, okay.
We have approximately 1,000 permit holders.
Right.
So
you guys are busy.
We're busy.
Bruce.
Yeah, one final question. It seems like an important cog in this process working is your review of the plans, because if someone doesn't complain, we never even see it. There's a couple been approved already. We never saw it and heard about it. So maybe you could just kind of walk me through a little bit of how that works with a specific issue, which is in attachment 4, page 2, the design standard for, which would be a 2A, peak stormwater runoff discharge rates. So what do you look for in plans that help you know that they've actually done that?
Okay.
I can read it. It's real quick.
Let's get to that, Bruce. So we can.
It says, post-development peak storm water runoff discharge rates shall not exceed.
Okay, attachment 4.
It's page 2. Attachment 4.
Okay.
Post-development peak storm water runoff discharge rates shall not exceed the estimated pre-development rate for developments where the increased peak storm water discharge rate will result in increased potential for downstream erosion. So when you get a permit, what do you look for to help you decide whether they've actually done that or not done that?
Okay. So essentially, they would, in their plan, basically have the plan to do it. So they would describe to us in their plan and make us feel comfortable with the fact that they are going to implement a post-construction program in their municipality that ensures that that occurs. So then they describe to us what their plan is to do that, so how they would do it, and then we decide whether or not that meets that permit requirement.
What do you look for, though? I mean, do you just kind of, you have anything that you're looking for that you kind of, your sort of checklist of things you want to see there and things that they have to demonstrate to you, or just kind of take whatever they give you and see if it looks reasonable and go with that? Or?
Well, essentially, we do take whatever they give us and see if it looks reasonable because we get so many different things, because each municipality is so different. So they're different by size, by population, by size, by area, different because they're on the coast or away from the coast. And so we look to see what they're telling us they plan to do and then determine whether or not what they describe actually fits the intent of the permit. So they could do that through many different ways.
Could you maybe give an example, like for Soledad or something, if you recall a specific method that they use?
I'm hesitant to do that in case I recall incorrectly. I don't want to choose a specific one, but I could give just a general example.
Good. Okay, that'd be fine.
So, for example, things like low-impact development. So where they might say all of our new developments that we're going to put in are going to have regional stormwater retention basins. So each development, rather than discharging straight to the storm sewer system and increasing runoff to that sewer system, is going to go to a retention basin where it can percolate and evaporate, and only in, you know, 100-year storms or something will it overflow and discharge to the city's storm sewer system or a creek or stream. So that would be like an example of something that would be proposed by a municipality. We would evaluate whether or not that fits the criteria.
That's a good example. I mean, this is one of the cases where there actually is a design goal.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you, in that, I don't see that necessarily it's shown to me that they've met that design goal. They're doing some good BMPs, but do the BMPs actually meet this goal of having post-development stormwater runoff not exceeding the pre-development stormwater runoff?
Okay. Sorry, I keep answering in generalities because I don't want to take up so much time, but I could be as specific, I guess, as you want me to. We require that they actually demonstrate that to us through calculations. So they would say that the basin for, so you have a development, and it's going to be 20 houses, and it's a new development. So before there was nothing at all, so it was just ag land or maybe just open area, green space. So they have to calculate how much runoff is going to come off of these 20 houses and the streets and curbs and gutters and sidewalks and driveways. And then they have to size that basin that all the water is going to go to. Their stormwater retention basin has to be sized based on the runoff that they're going to get from that size development. And they have to convince us that that basin is sized to hold, say, 100 years or whatever they're saying would equal out.
So the appropriate hydrologic effects.
Right.
So we can calculate.
Exactly.
Good. Okay, thank you.
And then furthermore, the discharge or the outlet cannot increase erosion. So if it's discharging to a creek or stream, we make sure that that actual outlet area will not cause erosion if they have an overflow event. So we take all of those things into consideration.
Right. Thank you.
Sure.
I noticed on page 9, under parking lots, there's a specific design criteria involving a reduction of impervious land coverage of parking areas. Are there other areas within attachment 4 where we're encouraging an increase in pervious hardscape?
Where we are encouraging an increase in pervious.
Pervious,
yeah.
You know, in
mm-hmm.
allowing infiltration.
Well, attachment 4, as you know, addresses these particular items that are right here, that are listed on page 2, those bulleted items, where you have single-family hillside residences, 1,000-square-foot commercial developments,
right,
automotive
lots.
Repair shops.
If you look at the bottom of page 5 and then the top of page 6 where they have the three ABCs and then, of course, 2, that's all flow-based and as one of the issues, I think, there is that they do talk about either infiltrate, filter, or treat. So infiltrate is certainly mentioned as a possible solution.
How do we, you know, encourage
exactly
Owendell concepts?
Yes.
Is it in through these provisions here? Is that clear enough?
Well, these provisions are part of the statewide general permit,
right.
So we can't change attachment 4,
right.
And there's various ways of complying with these requirements. If they're adequate to comply with the permit, we can't make them pick infiltration over other measures, right. But staff has to be confident that they're going to meet the MEP okay. requirement. But it is clear in the literature discussing the municipal program and in the findings of the general permit that one of the reasons that you need this program is because of the increase in impervious surfaces that results from development. So it's really clear that that's the whole foundation for having this program.
Okay. This is one area where I was wondering if we couldn't say that our preference is for infiltration, and that if they wanted to use the other two, filter or treat, they'd have to explain why they wanted to use that versus infiltration. That would certainly allow them those three options, but they would have to explain why they want to use the second two versus the first one. If we could do that, I think that would help us achieve what we're trying to accomplish here.
What do you think, Lori?
Well, we could certainly express a preference. I don't think that we can require them right. to justify why they're choosing something other than infiltration, because we don't have that authority under the general permit or anywhere under the general permit that I can think of off the top of my head. And we can't specify how they're going to comply with this. But, you know, again, staff does have to be confident that the suite of BMPs will satisfy the standard.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce, it all comes down to money. You know, and the most cost-effective BMP to do what needs to be done is what probably, you know, they're going to be choosing. Maybe there's some way to get the pervious hardscape information in their hands, you know, some of the videos, you know, that we have seen and that are on the Internet. I know the state of Washington has some programs that are pretty innovative, where they have removed buffers along streets and roads where there's been flooding, and they put impervious hardscape, and it's just remarkable how it reduces stormwater flow and reduces pollutants. I wonder if we could have that as part of our information package going back to the permit holders. Yes.
Yeah. We've put on a lot of workshops.
And does it have videos of?
Well, for example, one of the workshops that we did was actually at the Manzanita Housing Project, which the board visited,
right.
And that is an example of low-impact development. We put on a workshop there once a year. We've done it twice now, actually three times now. And so that way we invite all the municipalities within our region to come. We have experts there talking about low-impact development, as well as staff giving presentations on permit requirements and how this fits into the permit. And the Region Board staff encourages low-impact development and other measures such as those. So we put on workshops and try to encourage our permit holders to do those
now
things, provide them with that information.
The Santa Barbara area.
That
right.
example. The
right.
Manzanita
do
is
we have examples throughout the region?
We don't have as many examples as I would like to have, and that's one of the things that I'm working on, is to try to get some more incentives for having examples in other places throughout our region. One of the ideas is possibly using SEP money, you know, from enforcement actions to do an SEP project that could be an example. So that's one of the things that we're working on, is trying to get more examples throughout our region so that we don't just have to have workshops just in Santa Barbara to
right.
demonstrate that. So
I think that's a great idea and necessary. Yes. Mr. Briggs.
You mentioned that the economics are typically a driver, and of course we see that with another area like recycled water. If the, you know, the economics aren't there, it's pretty hard to force a reclamation project or recycling project. But I was wondering, how does it play in terms of the notion that if you don't have as much stormwater to convey and then filter and treat, retain, and therefore you either have smaller basins, which means less money for those basins, or you don't need to have those basins at all.
Mm-hmm.
How does that play, or do we have enough information yet to know about that?
We do have enough information, and I wish that I could just quote you all sorts of stuff right off the top of my head, but we do have information about this, and actually we present it in our presentations. It's really actually pretty exciting, because a lot of the information concerning actual cost of implementing low-impact development, best management practices, comes from places that have already been doing it for 10 years, such as Prince George's County in Maryland, and other places, for example, the C Streets program in Seattle. That was the C Streets program that actually took out the curbs and gutters and realigned the streets, putting in vegetation and actually conveying stormwater above ground rather than below ground in storm sewer systems.
Right.
And there's actual, so we have projects that have actually occurred, and there's data as far as how much it costs to implement those projects and maintain them. And it shows that it is less expensive to maintain an above-ground stormwater conveyance system than it is to maintain a below-ground stormwater conveyance system. So that is exciting and encouraging information that we make available at our workshops so that people can understand that. For example, in that C Streets example, which is one that I really love because of the fact that in Seattle when they did that, the residents of that street were very unhappy about the project. They didn't want it to happen at first. You know, they didn't want people to narrow their streets and take out their sidewalks and take out their curb and gutter. But then after the project was complete, after the curbs and gutters and sidewalks had been removed on one side, I think there's still sidewalks on one side of the street and removed on the other side, and they made the street sort of curvy instead of straight to reduce traffic impacts, and they planted lots of flowers and vegetation, and they made swales to convey the stormwater. It was beautiful afterwards. It was far more beautiful than curbs and gutters and sidewalks and wide streets. And then the residents loved it. And then the neighboring communities went to the city and demanded to have it in their street. They said, how come they got it and we didn't? So that's an exciting example of how it was publicly accepted. And then the city also later came out with a report that showed that the owners of those houses on that street sort of took that area where their vegetation had been planted and where the bioswale was as their own. They sort of took ownership of it, and they maintained it. They maintained the vegetation and the flowers. They mowed the lawn through the bioswale. So it actually cut down drastically on city maintenance because the residents saw that as an extension of their yard, essentially, and they took pride in it. So there's also examples of where low-impact development by using these above-ground stormwater conveyances throughout an entire development can actually decrease the cost of building the development because you don't have all of those underground utilities to put in place. And the cost of maintaining it is much less expensive because it's above ground. You can get to it. It's not something where you have to go below ground and replace the pipes over time. There's another example, actually not in our region, but in Davis, where there's a development that's been in place since the 1970s, and so there's lots of data from the city of Davis on that development and how the costs of maintaining that system are far less than anywhere else in the city of Davis.
Well, I think that this is important information to continue to get out, and I would love to see more demonstration, you know, projects in the region.
Me too.
Does the board need to help with this in some way? Or is it something staff is just working on anyway?
Well, we're working on it, but we would love to have support from the board. And Mr. Thomas has an idea about possibly implementing buffers and low-impact development. Do you want to discuss that?
Yeah, this is part of the Regional Board Conservation Program that we talked about back in June, which we've been working on. We're going to bring it back to the board. And the way we have it written right now, there are two pilot projects, one for low-impact development, doing exactly what Jennifer's talking about, and having that as an example, which will then springboard throughout the rest of our region, and an agricultural project where we implement, help fund best management practices, establish buffer zones, and collaborate with other groups to get matching funds for our funds.
Where are these two projects?
The location hasn't been determined yet. We were looking at the Salinas area and Santa Maria area as possibilities.
And how do you get people to want to do this? Are we getting funds to pay for?
People already want to do it. It's the lack of money.
Okay.
And Jennifer's been talking to folks about this for a long time. A lot of municipalities want to do this low-impact development work because, given the examples that she just talked about, people are attracted to them. And same thing on the agricultural side, but I think there's maybe less desire to do it on the responsible parties part than in the municipality arena. However, the big issue is money. And so what we're proposing in the conservation program is to direct SEP funds and enforcement funds into an account which will be used specifically for these types of projects. And a third task in the Regional Board Conservation Program, the way we have it written now, is to do a basin plan amendment. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier, a basin plan amendment on critical water quality habitat. That would be riparian corridors, wetlands, and their buffer zones, protecting them and making that part of our basin plan. So that's all coming.
Good. Also, Ms. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, Ms. Okun just made a suggestion and said it would be legal if we did it right, where the board members board members who would be interested could attend one or more of the workshops that we have, and, you know, as long as we notice your attendance, then
that'd be great.
We keep you out of jail.
We would love to have board members.
Either that or just have a workshop that's specifically targeted for the board, and any information from these various workshops that you might be interested in hearing would just be noticed as a public meeting, and people could come.
Dr. Press.
Just one last thing. When you do get to the non-traditional small MS4s, I know last night after I left there was some discussion about UC Santa Cruz and its ongoing construction. I would expect that most of these would never come to the board. Most of these non-traditional small MS4s are not going to come to the board. However, obviously in a case where you have one of these that is has a lot of construction ongoing for a long time, I would encourage that to come for you to kind of pick those out and give us status reports or some other way of I know UCSC has been increasing its impervious surface tremendously, and I mean, I live on campus, so I see the water coming down off the hill, and it's not good. So this isn't going to stop. The campus is growing, and it's going to grow for a lot longer. So I'm just saying the notion is that some of these should not fly under the radar. They should come up and get more attention, I think.
Okay. I would say that, in my opinion, none of them are under the radar. We're reviewing them all thoroughly. Although, if there are some that the board would like to have a hearing on,
I don't want to just pick on my home institution, but the criterion really, I think, should be that there is like Bruce do it is that there is a for some of these that are. That we know have undergone a lot of change and are continuing to do so, that would be a general criterion and reason for bringing them to our attention.
Okay. Yeah. I could also mention that all the stormwater management plans, when they are approved by staff, when they go on the web for 60 days, that might be an opportunity as well for the board to take a look at them. To see if that's something that, you know, you might have concern about. And if you like, I can place you on the IPL list, the interested parties list, so that you receive notification of when anyone goes on the web.
I think we should do that to all the board members, so at least we have notification.
Okay, you'd be happy to do that.
And also, as you said, we're providing the table as mm-hmm. an attachment to the executive officer's report, so you have that in the agendas as well to see how the phase twos are moving through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other board questions at this point? We have two speaker cards. And is this a joint presentation?
Yes.
Okay. We don't have 20 minutes for this. And I think we had requested some material to be sent to us before the board meeting.
We'll take 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes is fine. Right. Please come up. This is Mark Sullivan. And Kristen Jensen Sullivan. You two? And your card?
Hello.
Not that I don't know who you are.
Okay, 9 minutes total then.
Okay.
We have 9 minutes? Hello. Yeah, my name is Kristen Jensen Sullivan. This is Mark Sullivan. Thank you for your work, board members, staff, and hello to everyone. Mark Sullivan and I are both teachers of environmental studies, environmental science, and biology, and we also live in a solar straw bale home which is a sustainable home, and we do have tours every month if anybody's interested in low-impact development. And we wanted to just start out by saying that, and I'll let Mark take over.
And our objective is really relates directly, like I say, to what we were talking about here, is that we are would like to see the development of more infiltration standards into the Phase 2 stormwater permit prevention programs.
So we'll move quickly through the first part, which is on impacts of urbanization on aquatic resources, so that we can spend a little bit more time talking about runoff and infiltration-based solutions, and then we have some recommendations that we'd like to offer to the board.
So the impacts of urbanization on aquatic resources, four big ones are impacts to hydrology, geomorphology, water quality, and habitat degradation. So first we'll start with hydrology. And you're all aware of the hard problem with hardscape surfaces and the effects of that: increased flood peaks, increased stormwater runoff, more frequent flooding, and as a result, we see also lower dry weather flows.
Geomorphological effects of urbanization include stream widening and erosion, reduced fish passage, degradation of habitat structure, and fragmentation of riparian tree canopy. This is at the mouth of Soquel Creek, and you can see there's really no tree canopy there.
And as a result of that loss of the tree canopy, one of the effects of that on water quality are that we see increased stream temperatures. Of course, we also see increased pollutants as well, increased groundwater salinity levels. There's another effect of urbanization on water quality because of the groundwater pumping that happens, and then increased risk of beach closure, and this is a sign contaminated water unsafe for swimming or water contact. That's a permanent sign at the foot of Soquel Creek.
Pollutants entering into our waterways include suspended solids and sediments, nutrients, nitrogen and phosphates, for example, from fertilizers, metals such as copper, zinc, lead, and cadmium, for example, copper from brake pads or from copper roofs or gutters, and metal oils and grease from automobiles, bacteria from septic systems that aren't properly maintained, and pesticides and herbicides from uses outside of an urban setting or in agriculture.
And there are also effects of urbanization on habitat value, including buffer zone loss. We clear away all the large woody debris, create fish barriers. In some of the pictures you've seen, heavy siltation in Soquel Creek, and also eutrophication, which is, decrease in the dissolved oxygen levels, which make it hard for certain species of fish to survive because of increased algal growth.
So now in terms of what we'd like to encourage some of the following proven runoff reduction and stormwater infiltration solutions. And we'd like to go over what can be done right away in terms of pervious surfaces, recharge features, porous downspouts, and rainwater catchment.
And for pervious surfaces, four examples include porous asphalt and concrete, turf block, and crushed granite surfacing. And this is a picture of crushed granite surfacing, too, by the way. And, it's attractive, and it allows for infiltration of stormwater. So it's got both of those things going for it. I'll just mention that we live in the city of Capitola, and when we try to put a crushed granite driveway onto our driveway, they wouldn't allow it because they were afraid that we'd be dragging gravel all over the neighborhood. Well, so it's not only not encouraged, it's not allowed. Turf block is another example. It's one of the things that we use on our property. And, this is a close-up example, or close-up photo on the left. You can also use natives in there, drought-tolerant native plants. But you can see from a distance it looks like lawn. That's, another attractive way, and it's a great infiltration technique. And then permeable concrete and porous asphalt are another two examples. On the left, you can see that's a permeable concrete surface. It's appropriate for, you know, low traffic areas, parking lots, and that kind of thing. There is a certain amount of maintenance that goes along with these permeable concrete and porous asphalt, but, you know, it also gets you out of, you know, stormwater basins and that kind of thing. And so, you know, I think that they can be cost effective too.
In terms of recharge features, this is an example of what we have. An infiltration technique that we have outside of our in our yard, and there are lots of different kinds of features, including infiltration trenches and basins, bioretention systems, and open channel construction.
Oh, and this is a bioretention system that you can see. There's just vegetation in the middle of a parking lot there, and the storm drain is at the level so that if storm water rises to above the curb level, then it'll infiltrate into that storm drain. Another recharge feature that you were talking about earlier was this open channel construction idea, which is appropriate along roadways and that kind of thing. And you just plant vegetation into an open channel, which allows for infiltration. You can also use drought-tolerant natives so that, you know, I think that that's a better way to go. And this is a porous downspouts, or a simple idea of just putting, instead of, you know, taking the water that runs off of your roof and sending it straight into the storm drains, it's to create or put in a porous downspouts once the rainwater moves, you know, minimum, say, of 15 feet from the structures, then you can start using perforated piping so that it allows for infiltration of that rainwater coming off your roof, and it will infiltrate as opposed to going directly into the gutters and going into the storm drain system.
Okay. And associated with porous surfaces, porous structures, we wanted to include roofing and gutter materials. For example, the city of Palo Alto has done lots of scientific studies showing that copper actually coming off of copper roofs and copper gutters, there are increased concentrations of that copper. And so they actually have an ordinance that does not allow for copper roofing and gutter materials. So we would suggest perhaps an alternative of aluminum gutters, simply because, you know, galvanized as well would leach out zinc and nickel.
There's a copy of that ordinance, too, in the package that we gave you, but there's some information on that. Also, this is another good idea, is to use rainwater catchment systems or rainwater harvesting, and this is in our backyard. We have a 2,500-gallon tank where we collect rainwater during the wet season, of course. This year, we filled it up in 1 month. The month of December was wet enough, so that's full right now. And then we use it as a resource during the dry season, so that once our yard, because we have drought-native and drought-tolerant plants, and once our yard becomes established, we think that it's going to provide 100% of our water needs throughout the dry season. And if you don't have the room, or if you think that's kind of ugly, then you can also bury those.
So our recommendations to conclude then is we would hope that you would at least allow and encourage and maybe even require the MS4 permittees to use proven infiltration techniques to minimize stormwater runoff, and adopt a directive prohibiting the use of copper roofing materials in accordance with the City of Palo Alto ordinance.
And there's one slide left. And that is that in LA County, the LA County MS4 permit adopts a directive where one of the options is that you can that you have to infiltrate or treat a volume of runoff up to 3/4 of an inch of rainfall prior to discharge into a stormwater system. And I have a copy too of that in the packets as well, so we'd like to see that considered.
And the last slide asks for questions, if anybody, we didn't make enough of the handouts. If anybody wants extra handouts, we could certainly have those available, and anyone else that would like those. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the board?
The LA County thing is actually in use there. It was approved for use.
It was approved for use, and it's part of their permit now.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're preaching to the choir somewhat with a lot of this.
I realize that, right. But I did want to just bring out
right.
the LA ordinance and show you some of the methods that we were talking about.
And I think that's great. And I think you guys are great spokespeople for going to the Phase 2 permit holders and educating them. And even if they've been to some of Jennifer's workshops, you know, whether these are city councils or boards of supervisors, I think that they would benefit from your presentation. So I would encourage you to do that.
We'd like to do that.
Great. And I'm wondering, what about Jennifer, Lori, treating a certain amount of initial rainfall? You know, requiring
detention or retention.
Detention or retention on site before conveyance. Jennifer, did you
want to answer that question?
You were waiting for that.
Yeah, actually, that's actually in the phase 2 permit in attachment 4.
Okay,
that's the part that Mr. Daniels was reading a little bit earlier. He kind of briefly touched on that. The section where it talks about, I think it was on page 2. Talks about actually capturing and treating the 85th percentile. It's actually page 5, the very bottom, where it talks about volumetric treatment control BMPs,
right.
And then it goes through those three things.
Okay.
So one of those you'll see is volume and runoff produced based on the 24-hour rainfall criterion for treatment to the 85th percentile of 24-hour storm event. So that requires the capture and treat of certain storm events. So that is in the phase 2 permit, and it's also part of MEP for the phase 1 permits as well.
Right. It's in attachment 4 of the Salinas permit as well, or the draft Salinas permit.
We do require this
of the permit applicants, this kind of behavior?
Okay. Absolutely, definitely. And those applicants required to comply with attachment 4. Those were the ones with the asterisks in your staff report handout. So those that have the population of 50,000 or greater and that or a growth rate of 25% or more over 10 years. So that's required of those phase 2 permit holders and phase 1 permit holders, all of them.
That seemed a little different than my understanding of the L.A. requirement. The L.A. requirement, as I understand, was that it actually retained the first 3/4 inches, and this does talk about treatment as another option. So.
It's a capture or treat requirement, so they can either capture or treat that requirement. So, yeah.
Because the natural, if they take the treat avenue, that means they just filter it, and then off it goes, and you still have the volume problem.
I think that was the case in those more urbanized areas. It's probably difficult to capture, and so I think they allowed for treatment rather than capturing in those highly urbanized areas.
LA allows for infiltration.
We have one more speaker card, and was Mrs. Graves, was this a donation of your 3 minutes to their presentation?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I was hoping we would get some input from you.
It was a brilliant dual presentation.
Okay. All right. Anything to conclude this agenda item, Mr. Briggs? Or are we ready to consider what to do with the next one?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We did receive a letter from Monterey Regional Waste Management District, and it's a letter commenting on the State Board's industrial stormwater permit. I got copies for all the board members, but I'm not sure if it's necessary to pass that on to the board at this time. They are general requirements. They're not something we would respond to. It's something State Board staff would respond to.
Okay.
And these are directed to the State Board, but they've given us a copy.
Okay.
Well, as long as we have the copies, we might as well provide them, and if you're interested in seeing what their perspective is on it. Got them. As far as wrap-up, I think we have a whole laundry list of follow-up points here, which I'm not prepared to summarize right at the moment. But, a lot of things like being involved with workshops in the future and the direction from the board in terms of things to encourage. And things to watch for, bring forward, maybe some of the attachment 3, the more critical attachment 3 facilities. So anyway, I don't have a list, but we will go through and make sure that we follow up on all those items.
You know, and maybe part of this, I guess Jennifer's working on this the concept of some kind of a friendly competition through the region.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something, Jennifer, you're working on?
Yeah, in concert with perhaps the conservation program that Mr. Thomas was describing,
right.
Some sort of way
good.
Of making an incentive for someone to implement a low-impact development project in another location in our region by perhaps providing, you know, part of the funding or something like that through SEP money so that there would be an incentive to have a project like that.
Can you give us a staff report, maybe in a couple of board meetings?
Absolutely.
On where you guys are with implementing?
I'd be happy to.
That? In addition to some kind of the friendly competition within the region.
Okay.
Great.
We were going to be reporting. One of the things we already had on our list was to, for both Michael Thomas and Jennifer Bidding, to provide a report for you on the whole low-impact development and the items that Michael was talking about at the next board meeting.
Okay. Good. All right. What do we... want to do. Thank you. That'll conclude 25, correct?
Yes.
And then we'll decide
yes.
how we're going to start with 26.